From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. A brief program note, they live in both real and virtual worlds. They post their new baby's pics on Facebook. They blog, vlog, and chronicle their daily lives digitally. Their Generation Net. Join Neil Conan and Don Tapscott on his new book, Grown Up Digital, next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. But for now, we're talking about science and beauty. In 1609, Galileo built a new optical device, a tube with lenses. His telescope was pretty weak compared to the ones we use to gaze at the heavens today, but he turned it on the moon and was startled to see its lumpy, cratered surface, far different from the smooth and perfect sphere famous scholars and philosophers had described. Soon afterwards, he turned his telescope toward Jupiter and discovered four moons orbiting the giant planet. He made dozens of drawings of his observations and published them in 1610 in a book called The Starry Messenger. You can take a look at one of these original volumes of Galileo's observations and even peer through a replica of his telescope at a new exhibition called Beautiful Science, Ideas That Changed the World. It opens this weekend at California's Huntington Library, that's in Pasadena, and it highlights the arc of scientific research through the centuries. My next guest has spent several years delving into these beautiful stories of science from Galileo's time to today. Let me introduce him now. Daniel Lewis is the Dibner Senior Curator of History of Science and Technology at the Huntington Library in San Marino, which is right next to Pasadena, California. He joins us from the studios of KPCC in Pasadena. Dan Lewis, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Joe. Happy Halloween.
Thank you. I wonder if they're out in force in Pasadena now, but we'll talk about that later. let's start by asking the question, this notion, beautiful science, what are you trying to capture in this exhibition?
Well, one of the things that this does is sort of crook a seductive finger towards an unwitting public, because talking about science and talking about history has the potential to be a doubly eye glaze over topic for a visiting public, and I know that science is beautiful and muscular and delicate, and it's beautiful in different ways. And so, to talk about beauty is to talk about a number of specific things, but it's also a chance to talk about different kinds of beauty, because there's certainly not one certain stripe of beauty, and at times it is like a delicate clock, at times it's a very robust, burly sort of thing. And some of these works in the exhibit, as I assembled this over the last couple of years, if you look at them visually, they're really spectacularly uninteresting in textual form. And I'm trying to break away from library exhibits, at least, where you find yourself staring into a case, looking at something like Charles Darwin's Origin of Species, which is 502 pages long and has but a single illustration in all that text, and it's a chart in the illustration. So there's a beautiful idea behind that relatively uninteresting visual object that is of vital and giant importance. Other works are really spectacular visually. They range from the beautiful and gory in the medical domain to the first illustrations of the moon under magnification by Galileo, as you mentioned. So it spans a wide spectrum.
It's as you know, I've seen some of the pieces in the exhibit, and they are mesmerizing. I'd like to ask our listeners if they would like to join the conversation to please give us a call. The number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. I guess I should say this exhibit's going to be around for a while, so it's not like you have to run out and see it tomorrow.
It's a permanent exhibit, and permanent exhibits are challenging for all institutions, whether it's a museum or a library. That's because light is the enemy of artwork and paper and ink, and so we actually have conservators come in to do a page change anywhere from 12 weeks to 6 months for a work. So there's a lot of activity making sure that things aren't damaged by the materials. And just as scientists are stewards of historical ideas over the centuries, curators and libraries are also stewards of material that really is just passing through their hands that they really hope will be preserved for future generations. So there's really a long-term stewardship notion to physical protection of the material in library exhibits.
So we've talked some about the Galileo Starry Messenger. What are some of the other greatest hits of the kinds of volumes and pictures that they'll be able to see in the exhibit?
Well, so many things, Joe. We've got Isaac Newton's own copy.
We've only
of the
got
Principia.
About 15 more minutes. So
this is my challenge.
Yeah.
Exhibits always take up a tiny fraction of a percent of a library's holdings. Library exhibits do, and so it's challenging to find things that tell a story and are high spots as well. But we've got Isaac Newton's own copy of the Principia Mathematica, his great work on the structure of the laws of the universe, and it has annotations in his own hand. It's not the only copy. Newton had other copies. He annotated more extensively, but we certainly have that one. We've also got Newton's own copy of the Optics, which was his great work on optics, in another section of the gallery, which is in four parts: astronomy, natural history, medicine, and then light and optics. We've got stars, superstars, in every one of the sections. We've got Robert Hooke's Micrographia in the natural history section, accompanied by a facsimile of a microscope where you can look at a flea, Pulgens irritans is the flea that Hooke drew and that is represented there. And I've been trying to find a 17th century flea to show on the slide for this microscope to go with the 17th century illustrations on the book. So there's Robert Hooke. There are a whole bevy of beautiful medical works. Robert Hunter's book on the gravid uterus, the state of the body during pregnancy. A fabulous book by a Frenchman named Gautier d'Agoty with these beautiful mezzotints from the 18th century in color. Very, very rare and very labor-intensive process. So these works span a bunch of different types of artistry as well as a bunch of different topics and different ideas that work their way along through this notion of beautiful science.
Okay, let's take another call now, or take a call now and go to Andrew in Philadelphia. Andrew, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, love the show.
Thanks.
I just wanted to make the observation that I've lately fallen in love with astrolabes, Islamic ones in particular, from I think the 12th century. I saw some in the Smithsonian, and I've seen some photographs and books, and I think they're just spectacular artistically.
Okay, that's interesting. And Dan Lewis, are you familiar with these Islamic works?
Astrolabes are wonderful, and they stem out of an Islamic tradition. And one of the things that came along with this collection that evolved into this exhibit is something called the Burndy Library, which was based at MIT for many years. And in the Burndy Library were a series of objects that are based on astronomical observation, either for direct observation or as didactic teaching tools. So along with astrolabes, I don't have any astrolabes in the exhibit because they're often big, not always, and there were very few in the Burndy collection. But I've got spectacular sundials, which date back to the 16th century. And I've got what's called an armillary sphere, which, and the one we have is one that's been in the Huntington's collections for many decades. It dates to about 1550. And they're bands of strips of wood that serve as a model for rotating the heavens around, in this case, the Earth, which proved to be incorrect because the heavens don't rotate around the Earth. But it's a way to, they're really beautiful visually, and they let you perform operations and move things around. But astronomers also use really big instruments. So Tycho Brahe, the Swedish astronomer based in the island of Hvin, had these gigantic tools he used for naked eye astronomy, something called the Mural Quadrant. I've got a great big work, an atlas by Johann Blau, showing one of these Mural Quadrants of Tycho Brahe's. And so the tools of astronomy were really spectacular. One of the greatest works in the history of astronomy is something called the Astronomicum Caesarium by Petrus Oppianus, printed in 1540 in Ingolstadt. And it, Owen Gingrich, who's a well-known historian of science and an astronomer at Harvard, has called this the most beautiful scientific book ever printed. And I'm not, that's a hard superlative to use in a field rich with goodies, but it really is spectacular. And it makes use of these rotating paper discs or volvelles to perform astronomical calculations. They were very accurate, to within perhaps a minute of arc in some cases. And it's lavishly printed and lavishly colored and done as an homage to a king. And it's not often, if ever, seen on exhibit. So that's up in the astronomy section of the exhibit.
We're talking with Daniel Lewis about his new exhibit, or the new exhibit, but I guess you can call it his, at the Huntington Library that shows science, or beautiful science. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's go now to James in Cincinnati, Ohio. James, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering, with this exhibit included with maybe the ancient like Incan and Mayan stuff where they were able to predict the movement of the stars and moons and stuff with great precision, and all the artifacts from that, and also from Egypt and those types of areas like before Common Era.
Okay, interesting.
I'll take my answer off.
Okay, great. Thanks, James.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, Daniel
that's
Lewis. Prehistoric, yeah.
That's a field called archaeoastronomy, and it's widely represented and talked about. The exhibits always emerge out of the contents of an institution's collections, and so a lot of this archaeoastronomy isn't stuff that is easily collectible in paper form. So if it's on a gigantic piece of stone sitting in a Mayan village, it's hard to work into the exhibit. There's a bit of that. This exhibit tends to privilege Anglo-American astronomy and to some degree Islamic astronomy, which is another grand traditional source of astronomical discovery and knowledge. So a lot of the archaeoastronomy doesn't show up in this exhibit. It's not placed well as a material type for an exhibit. It's hard to show, as I said, some of these really gigantic things. If I had more space, I could have expanded into a newer, a really, really comprehensive set of things. So this has a particular focus. It doesn't include the archaeoastronomy details.
Okay, interesting. Let's take another call now from Mary in Louisville, Kentucky. Mary, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for taking my call. I really enjoy the program. I'd like to ask if you have had a particular focus on how women have contributed to science. I know that probably there's a publication bias in the ancient times towards that, but I was curious if you had noticed that at all, or if you tried to find manuscripts and et cetera.
Interesting.
And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you, Mary. Dan Lewis, women.
There's a great tradition of women in the history of science in every domain, and even though it tended to be men as a rule working in science, women made many vitally important discoveries and observations, and I've got a number of works in there that really speak to that. A woman named Maria Sibylla Marion did a spectacular volume on the insects of Suriname that I've got up in the exhibit and in digital form as well. So you can turn the pages of this spectacular work. A very brave pioneer who went to Suriname with her daughter and collected and drew for quite some time these insects and plants of Suriname. Annie Jump Cannon, a 20th century astronomer at Mount Wilson who classified stars by the tens of thousands, writes a great letter about how she hates to go on vacation because she's leaving behind her star catalog and wishes she could keep working on it. Caroline Herschel, one of the great Herschel family of astronomers, as observational work that's mentioned and covered in the show. There's also a section in the medicine subsection on childbirth, which is a particular strength of the Huntington's collections, but is also obviously a female topic. And midwives, for many centuries, were the ones who facilitated birth and knew the most about the birthing process. We have a really, really rare ivory model. It's an obstetrics model from about 1550 with removable parts. So this ivory model is a woman laying there, and you can remove the belly and then remove the viscera and kind of work your way down to the little fetus inside as a teaching tool. So,
Very interesting.
The childbirth section is something that speaks to women's issues.
Excellent, excellent. We're talking with Dan Lewis about a new exhibit at the Huntington Library. I'm Joe Palka, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's take another call now. This time we'll go to Paul in Portland, Oregon. Paul, welcome to Science Friday.
Yes, I'm just curious as to whether you know about Adam Elsheimer's painting of the night sky. It was done in Rome in 1609, and it includes the details of Galileo's sky.
Wow.
I always thought, they must have known each other. He was an extremely detailed and slow painter. And I actually have a print that was done in 1611 of this painting, and it just seems extraordinary. I've never found any actual historical connection between the two, but they had to know each other.
Well, possibly, but you say Elsheimer is the name.
Yes, Adam Elsheimer.
Okay, Dan Lewis.
I must confess, I haven't heard of Adam Elsheimer. The telescope came along in about 1608, and was patented simultaneously by three different people. Galileo wasn't the first to use a telescope, certainly, and he was the first to produce a printed work, but I have not heard of this mural. I'd be really curious to hear more about that. That's a really interesting fact.
The painting itself is in a museum in Germany, and I've been fascinated by it by a long time.
Yeah.
Because I just think they had to know each other, because it's an amazing, the first truly amazing painting of the night sky, very detailed and very accurate.
Paul, thanks very much for that. You know, it doesn't surprise me, actually, that artists unconnected specifically with science have been drawn into science, because when we were looking into flooding issues in Venice, for example, in Italy, some of the famous paintings from the Venetian school showed buildings that are still around today, and you can see where the water line was. So you get some information from the painting that way.
There are all sorts of clues in the visual record about many different things. Speaking of evidence in books and manuscripts, one of the things that is that Isaac Newton did with his own books was he would actually dog-ear the pages of the book to point to a particular passage. So if there was a paragraph in there he wanted to highlight, he'd dog-ear the page up from the corner or down from the corner so it pointed to it. And that's behavior we don't usually prohibit, don't allow in our reading room. And so I'm going to have these books in the Burundi Library that go out with dog ears, but they're really direct physical evidence. That sort of thing, like the water line in a painting, shows you know how there's a life to these things, and it's one of the things I love about old books and manuscripts is there's a life to them. They have stains and fingerprints and marginalia written in the margins of books. And the subtitle of this exhibit is "It's Beautiful Science: Ideas That Changed the World." And that's my stand-in for saying history, which is a word that's nowhere in the exhibit, because of the fact that these things are a continuum over a long period of time, from the distant past up to the present and then on into the future.
All right, we'll have to leave it there, Dan. Thanks for that lovely thought at the end. Dan Lewis is the Dibner Senior Curator of History of Science and Technology at the Huntington Library in San Marino. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for joining me today. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had outstanding help from NPR librarian Key Molesky. If you have comments or questions, write to us. The address is scifry@npr.org. Check out sciencefriday.com for more information and links to today's program. You can listen to past editions of Science Friday online or take them with you as a podcast. Ira Flatow will be back next week for NPR News in Washington. I'm Joe Palca.